Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by BetOnline.ag. NFL Week 7 recap show. Monday Night Football on the docket as well. I am your fearless leader, Todd Furman. I'm joined, as always, by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only, Payne Insider. What's going on, my good man?
It's Monday.
We're going to leave it at that. It's Monday.
It's Monday.
We tell people all the time, in this business, you can't have a case of the Mondays because every day blends together.
That is accurate. That is accurate. Today is what, the 22nd of October. I just found that out today.
Time flies when you're having a good time. Of course, a Monday show, we'll talk about what we saw over the weekend, in the good, the bad, and the ugly. Dr. David Chow, you can follow on Twitter, at ProFootballDoc, fills us in on all the biggest injuries that you may or may not have missed from the weekend that was. We got some look-ahead lines. We have a Monday Night Football breakdown between the Falcons and Giants. But Payne, let's start with what's fresh in our mind, that 45-10 thrashing we saw last night doled out by the Kansas City Chiefs.
I didn't watch much of it. I got to be honest with you. I fell asleep at halftime. I said, this thing's over. Once Kansas City builds a lead, you're just not going to be able to get enough stops to get back in the game. And it was a coaching mismatch. The one thing I think we talked about on Thursday was the Bengals were going to be the professional side, but you couldn't pay me to be on them. Just the head coaching matchup. Just glaring. El Stupido versus...
That Spanish of yours is top shelf, by the way.
Against Andy Reid. So that was never going to work out well. And we talked about the Bengals' defensive issues this season. Then they were dealing with injuries to Nick Vigil, the guy who gets them lined up. So it was going to be ugly. They're missing tackles nonstop, too. They couldn't tackle. That's just a very overrated football team.
The thing about it, too, that was crazy, I mean, we can poke holes in the Bengals' defense and say they were to blame, but their offense, 202 yards, 13 first downs, and 10 points against this Kansas City defense. And I know Chris Collinsworth and Al Michaels said, oh, Kansas City's defense isn't as bad as the metrics and this, that, and the other. That was pathetic from Cincinnati not to have a better game plan, to get the ball to your playmakers and even get Tyler Boyd involved. It felt like it was A.J. Green and Andy Dalton, like this was the Bengals circa 3 years ago.
So, again, like Marvin Lewis is inept. I believe he now moves to 9-32 in primetime spots. So he continually shows the world like he's not good and doesn't put his players in position to succeed. Things were so bad last night, I saw the box score this morning. There's a Jeff Driskel sighting, apparently. That's never going to go well.
And overbetters were holding on for dear life late, hoping that they were going to get a shot to cash their ticket after the Chiefs said, "Nah, we're not going to kick the field goal inside the 10. We're going to try and run a sweep to Spencer Ware to score the most important touchdown of the game." The only reason I'm sure a lot of people were watching in the wee hours.
The one thing I did notice, at least early on, was Bob Sutton in the Chiefs' defense. They made like a little tweak. They were stacking the box on early downs and forced the Bengals to either run into a stack box or to throw into what their strength is, which is the secondary, it appears. Again, I talked about this on Thursday. No clue what's going on with Skandrick. It's a guy that was paid $1 million to go away from Washington. And then after that, visited like 3-4 teams, including the Dolphins, who needed secondary help. Everyone passed. He has been a slot guy his entire career. Now somehow having success on the outside. If you're a Chiefs fan, enjoy it while it lasts. Hopefully it lasts all season. But I'm not sure how you're getting that kind of performance out of Skandrick. But right now, the Chiefs secondary seems to be their strength. So in early downs, I noticed this week specifically, Bob Sutton was just stacking the box, daring you to throw it. And Andy Dalton, that offense wasn't very good.
I think the most impressive part was during the telecast, they mentioned that Andy Reid says he pays no attention to run defense in the modern NFL. And clearly Kansas City with their offense, they put so much pressure on you. Oftentimes it doesn't matter if you start giving up 5 yards a carry if you're scoring from 65 to 70 yards out. So that, I guess, the Bengals will put in the bad. Kansas City, of course, gets credit for being very good. But what other things jumped out to you in the positive direction yesterday in all the NFL viewing pain?
I actually liked what I saw from the Redskins' run defense. That was the big thing for me. They struggled a little bit in that area this year. I know they were middle of the pack in yards per attempt allowed, but when you looked at the success rate metrics, Washington, they were 28th in rushing success rate defense. They completely choked out the Cowboys' ground attack. Zeke was non-existent. Watched every snap of that game. 2.2 yards per attempt. And I think if you can negate Elliott in that ground game, you're going to set yourself up obviously nicely to beat Dallas. And of course, you know, it wouldn't be a Cowboys game without Jason Garrett doing something to shit on himself.
You didn't like the end of the game situation, the execution where Tony Romo in the booth is saying, hey, here's what I would do to get myself another play. And Jason Garrett, we not need no part of this.
Two plays in nearly a minute. That's tough to do. 52 seconds, I believe. He only managed two plays. And then because his team isn't disciplined, got a false start. And that 5 yards seems to be the difference in that game. Because my feeling is another 5 yards closer, that probably dings the post and goes in rather than out.
That was interesting, though, because there were some prominent commentators, and I can't remember what network, saying that it was actually the wrong penalty that was called there that shouldn't have been an illegal snap. Infraction. At the same time, though, like you said, you run two plays in 52 seconds. Like, get the ball inside the 20, kick the 37-yard chip shot, and you're going overtime with all the momentum. Don't settle for a field goal coming from 47 yards out.
Yeah, I mean, it's just ineptitude every single week from Jason Garrett. Had a nice game plan last week against Jacksonville. Couldn't follow it up on the road. I didn't mind how that game started. I saw you tweeted out something about the game potentially being a bad beat for overbetters. I don't know where you got that from.
I mean, it's just the way it unfolded late with the Cowboys and Redskins. There was no doubt that under was the right side in that contest, but when a ball clings the upright from, you know, 50 out and it would have gotten to 40, thankfully there were some folks that may or may not have had the foresight to go under in the first half, which was the definition of a rocking chair winner.
I got to monitor your tweets more often. So I can inquire about them on this fine podcast.
Well, I mean, I have a stern rule. I mean, for anybody that's followed me on Twitter, I mean, you and I joke about it. I do not tweet about games that I actually am invested in until that investment is either over in the first half or the game's completely done. So people are like, how come you don't talk about some of the biggest games? I have a rule, whether it's gambling superstition or not, I do not tweet about a football game where I'm actually invested.
That's interesting.
While the game is in progress.
I know some of your colleagues like to celebrate wins before they're actually in the bag.
Oh, that colleague. I mean, he can go with the name. I call him out all the time. I tell Clay he's got to wait till the game's in the bag before he starts his premature celebration. But, you know, when you talk about ineptitude from the Cowboys, what better way, and I don't want to go the negative, but I think we have to talk about the Jaguars' ineptitude, Payne. First time in franchise history, they go three games scoreless in the first half. We see Blake Bortles bench for Cody Kessler. They haven't led during this entire losing streak. And despite holding the Texans to 4.4 yards per play, they really had no chance in yesterday's football game.
Yeah, I think you pretty much said it all. I mean, I think they've had 8 scoreless quarters the last 3 games, and they've been outscored 57-0 in the first half. To me, they have completely abandoned their identity. It's supposed to be a run-first team, rely on your defense type of ball club. I know there's O-line injuries, there's running back injuries, but you have to get back to being who you are, whether it's Bortles or Kessler. You can't be a pass-happy team.
Yeah, I mean, you just don't have the quarterbacks for it, and I'm sure that there'll be a lot of speculation swirling about, can the Jaguars go out there and get a quarterback to try and come in there, whether it's maybe, you know, T-Mobile coming in from Cleveland, you try and throw the kitchen sink at Teddy Bridgewater. I mean, this is a window for that defense that they're going to see closed because of inept quarterback play. This isn't like the Baltimore Ravens circa, what was it, 2000, where you could win with a game manager and not score an offensive touchdown for 5 weeks and still win the Super Bowl.
It sounds about right. I don't think Teddy Bridgewater's touchable right now, from what I'm hearing.
I mean, the Saints have put themselves in a good spot, and we may as well talk about them. I mean, Taysom Hill comes on. I mean, he's had packages designed for him on fourth down. You love the brass balls from Sean Payton. But Drew Brees continues to find ways. I mean, the Saints' offense, sluggish for three quarters. They outscore the Ravens 17-6 in the fourth. Albeit it took a Justin Tucker missed extra point, the first in his career. He was 222 for 222 beforehand, depriving us of overtime. But that's a big road win for the Saints, and a team all of a sudden who's really put that 48-40 defeat against Tampa Bay Bucks week one in the rear view.
Huge. And we talked about this before we got on the podcast, that huge third and eight conversion with pressure barreling down Drew Brees from inside. Got flushed to his right, found Michael Thomas diving, and he just extends across the first down marker. That was the game-changing play. I do want, you mentioned Taysom Hill. I kind of want to rant about him a little bit.
Yes.
Fantastic kid.
Yes, I want to rant. All right, give it to me.
He's a good kid. Like, I like him. And but it's obvious, like, Sean Payton has finally come to that realization. He's not the future quarterback because he's lining him up at tight end. You're allowing him to, like, challenge linebackers and safeties in open space. I'm all for the curveball or the changeup, right? Make opposing defenses spend, like, an extra day or 6 hours, whatever it is, preparing for Taysom Hill packages. But, like, on fourth and two, on critical downs, I don't want the guy under center. Like, we're going to be forgetting who this guy is when his career is over. Like, stop being the smartest dude in the room, Sean Payton. Like, just let Drew Brees have the ball on critical downs. Like, you know, first ballot Hall of Famer, completing 80% of his passes. Like, keep it in his hands. That stuff drives me nuts. And it's like the opposite, right? It was like one of those games where it's like, hey, which backup quarterback can we implement into this more? And it's like Baltimore has a different situation, right? You're designing packages for Lamar Jackson just so you can justify your first-round pick on him, right? This is a team in Baltimore that should be competing for a Super Bowl. You think maybe a first-round guy could have contributed this year? Like, it's a different situation there. We're trotting out Lamar Jackson so we can justify the first-round pick.
You know what,
you don't have to do that in the Saints.
You know what the Taysom Hill thing reminds me of? I mean, you used to watch a lot of CFL, and, like, third and short all the time, they would bring in their second-string quarterback to run the quarterback sneak. That's what it reminds me of.
I'm going, CFL move, right?
Yeah, it's a very CFL move. Instead of just letting the best player on the field, your starting quarterback, have the football in his hands in critical downs.
I'm okay if you're going to do it in different spots and different situations. Do it at midfield, bring him in for a play here or there. But, like, we're talking about, we're in scoring zone and we're having Taysom Hill on, like, fourth and three, pitch a ball backwards, and he can't even pitch it correctly. Like, when we're inside the 10, like, you can't take the ball out of Drew Brees' hands there.
No, I didn't like that, but impressive win from the Saints nonetheless. And an individual performance, Payne, that stood out for me. I mean, I don't think it'll come as a surprise. He's a household name. Aaron Donald, absolute wrecking ball yesterday for the Rams. I mean, I think Pro Football Focus had him as their top-rated defender for the week as far as overall grades. 4 sacks, 9 tackles, 1 forced fumble. Is there anybody in the league right now that's as disruptive of force as he is? And I know there's plenty of Bear fans out there listening, but you know what? Khalil Mack still isn't Aaron Donald.
I'm shocked. A little interior lineman love on the podcast. This is interesting. I like it. I didn't watch a single snap of that game. I'm going to go back and watch it this week. Unfortunately, I have to do that. you know, it sounds like Donald was dominating, and he's every single year. He grades out the best interior lineman. Like, it's not close. He is the best. What's shocking to me, though, is how poorly the 49ers offensive line is playing. And we've kind of talked about that from the preview podcast. A couple weeks this season, like, they have 4 first-rounders on that offensive line. They went out this season, got Weston Richburg, the center, signed him to, like, this massive 5-year, $48 million deal. So you could handle guys like Aaron Donald. You know, you're playing him in your division twice and potentially more if you were to go to the playoffs. It's not going to happen this year, but that was the idea that, hey, we're going to play the Rams at least twice. We got to go get this big name center, sign him to a big deal so we can handle Aaron Donald. And it just hasn't been the case.
When you look, Payne, at some of the other things that we saw unfold, I mean, the Eagles, they have a 17-0 lead going into the fourth quarter. They're outscored 21-0. Now, I know there was professional money that came in on the Panthers, but Carolina gains 371 yards for the entire game. 236 of those yards came on the fourth quarter touchdown drives. I mean, what is going on in Philadelphia? They can't close out football games. I mean, this is Carolina at home, and a couple weeks ago, we saw an inept Titans offense go up and down on the field in crunch time.
Listen, teams just don't perform as well after the Super Bowl. That's obvious. There's a bunch of guys that are banged up. For me in this game, as you mentioned, professional money on Carolina. And I know you got some good intel. There was a little flu bug going around, and I kind of shot you a note that said it was happening earlier in the week. Some of the guys are over it. But for me, when I looked at this game, and it's probably going to tick some people off, I wasn't sure what the Panthers were doing. And what they were very successful late in the game. But they should have been doing that all game, right? They weren't competent enough. Norv Turner wasn't competent enough to plan properly. I know Norv wants this like run first offense. He wants to get the ball out quick, and that's worked so far because Cam has been hit the least amount of any quarterback in the NFL on dropbacks. But the way to beat Philly's defense is through the air, and it's challenging them with the intermediate and deep routes. Norv didn't game plan for that early. If you go back right now, look at every play-by-play for the first half of that game through three quarters, the play-by-play is like nauseating. It's run, it's run again, it's a short pass. That plays right into the hands of the Eagles defense, right? Plays right into the hands of the defensive line, plays right into the hands of their linebackers with Hicks and Bradham who can cover a little bit. You must attack Philly's secondary. They had injuries, by the way, there. So when you look at Cam, I know we don't think he's this accurate passer, but if you look through his entire career at his accuracy percentages, when you adjust for depth of throw, he's one of the best deep passers in the league. So what happens is Norv's forced, because he's down 17 late, to actually, he lucks into the game plan he probably should have had. And what do you know? It actually works, and it leads him to victory. So it's like one of these things where it's like, yeah, you hate to bash the Carolina Panthers in a victory, but they were so goddamn inept. Norv Turner was so damn stupid all game. And finally, the game situation called for him to do the right thing. He luck boxed into that. and here we go. They beat the Eagles doing what they should have done all game. It's probably a blowout win if they had this plan of attack from the onset.
Well, every now and again, you happen to luck into a little bit of fortune. And in this case for Carolina, it was an outright victory as a 4.5, 5-point underdog against the Philadelphia Eagles. Payne, before we shift gears and take a gander at some of the look-ahead adjustments after Week 7 results, wasn't sure if there was anything else you wanted to call attention to, either in the positive manner, negative manner, or otherwise interesting from yesterday's games.
I have a feeling you're trying to set me up here.
I mean, I was going to give you an opportunity for a rant. You can either take the bait or you don't have to take the bait. It's entirely up to you.
You're attempting to lure me into the Bears, aren't you?
I was going to. I mean, I was going to put a little bait out there and set a bear trap, so to speak. But if you weren't going to take it, I wasn't going to, like, force you into it.
I don't want to be old man, get off my porch guy. I don't want to go on, like, one of those Matthew Berry rants about Alfred Morris getting 1 yard.
Oh, that was an epic rant, by the way. Absolutely epic for fantasy feek, folks. That made me laugh to no end.
That was a tough game to stomach because the Bears special teams were bad and they allow the kickoff return, which kind of zapped momentum. They were up 10 at that point. If you do watch the All 22 or you throw on the NFL Game Pass, whatever you use to rewatch games, there is a massive missed block in the back. Defender goes like flying through the air. And I know we've kind of talked about this. I know me and you talk about it all the time, but certainly I think we made mention of this on the podcast for about the last 13 months or so. We are just not winning games unless they are the dead right side of games. Like the games where there's a coin toss or we're leading or we're favored in live wagering. We're just not winning them right now. It has to be like Nevada. It has to be like, you know, the Jags first half under, like it has to be the dead right side. And so this is a game where you give up 14 on special teams. It looks pretty important when you lose by 7. And then, of course, the history goes against us. It wouldn't be one of our games if there wasn't a 354-game sample that wasn't snapped. The Patriots got the blocked punt and score first in 354 games. So that was surely going to happen here. And then, you know, you throw in the two picks deep in plus territory, which honestly, you know, you mentioned Trubisky and we thought maybe he gets baited in some throws. They weren't that bad of throws. Like, not being that guy, and it's so funny because the interceptions, if you go back and watch at them, like J.C. Jackson has the pick. He's literally swatting down on the ball. He's not even trying to pick it. He's trying to break it up. And it somehow just kind of, it was a deflection. It lands in his chest. He's the Patriots' fifth best corner. And then you have the backup safety there making the play of his life. Now, admittedly, that the Mitch ball was underthrown. If it's thrown nice, it's a walk-in touchdown. It's underthrown, but it, you know, it's probably just batted up. But you know, the third-string safety makes the play of his life. And so that one was brutal. I won't even talk about the other stuff because it was pretty 50-50. You did get the fumble, which was a nice recovery there on the kickoff. But then that evened out, right, because Edelman donked one off his face mask fielding ball inside his own five, and he battled two Bears and somehow got it out. So that those two things surely evened out. But other than that, it was a good Bears game.
Yeah. just maddening overall, and it seems, you know, you have these weekends all the time as a professional bettor. You kind of fight through them. You hope those breaks even out. They haven't seemed to, as you mentioned, over the last year or so. But, hey, if we didn't have bad luck in this business, Payne, we'd have no luck at all, the way I look at it.
Well, see, and here's the thing. It'll be like, oh, my God, he's so biased. He was on the Bears. Like, I'm not even mentioning the fluke play. Like, I don't even want the Hail Mary at the end. Like, you know, I don't even give a shit about that.
No, the Hail Mary. People, the, yeah. You're not the
it's
Hail
not
Mary
a play
in the
you're
grand
expecting
scheme of
to get. Yeah, like, yeah, I know people on social media were like, oh, we almost had this, we almost had the Hail Mary. Like, yeah, I don't even care about that.
there are other plays during the game that ultimately cost you. And like you said, the coin flips sometimes don't break your way. You put your head down and you plow through it and look towards, you know, some of the other games. And a couple numbers, Payne, that saw what I would call significant adjustments based on 1 week's worth of results. We may as well go to the London game. It's a game that we'll obviously talk about in greater detail on the Thursday podcast. But look ahead number for Philadelphia and Jacksonville was slated to be a pick'em. We see Jacksonville stub their toe yet again. Philadelphia spit the bit in against Carolina. But you see the Eagles now move to a three-point favorite. This number trending to 3-20. We're not sure who the Jags starting quarterback's going to be. And I actually feel bad for our friends across the pond because this was supposed to be the ultimate London game. You were going to get the NFC, you know, defending Super Bowl champion. You're going to get an AFC frontrunner in the Jaguars. And all of a sudden, we're talking about two teams struggling to keep themselves afloat.
Spit the bit. I like that. Listen, huge game for two teams, I think. And as you mentioned, they both had high hopes. They're both now below 500. And for me, I kind of agree with the line movement, right? You just, when you look at the matchup, you're really going to have to wonder how Jacksonville's offense, which again doesn't have an identity right now, can exploit the weakness of the Eagles' defense, which is their secondary. You know the Eagles are going to choke out the non-existent ground game for the Jags. Maybe.
Carlos There's Hyde,
a,
bro.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There's a little more Carlos Hyde mixed in this year. But whether it's Bortles or Kessler, they're going to have to make plays through the air to have a chance here. I don't know if that's going to happen, right? The Eagles kind of throw up on themselves in the last quarter. They were pretty good. They're the dominant team through three quarters. This feels like the market's actually somewhat correct because we'd view this differently. If this game opened pick like it should have been with two teams losing, you know, we're probably burying the Eagles.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to argue that whatsoever. I mean, I think it's a terrible matchup for Jacksonville. Now, Jacksonville's level of familiarity going across the pond maybe works in their favor.
Yeah, that's a help.
But, I mean, this is going to be a game that I think will go a long way in defining who these two teams are, not only for this week, but also going forward. I had another game marked down, but I think I want to gloss over it because it's not through key numbers. We have seen a three-point adjustment, but through the zero, so I don't think it's worth our time, Payne. Do want to talk a little bit and tease the Sunday night game, which I'll say is potentially the marquee matchup of all of NFL Week 8. Current line has the Vikings a one-point favorite, one-and-a-half-point favorite at betonline.ag. The Saints come in looking for revenge for what unfolded last year in the NFC playoffs. Look-ahead number here was the Vikings -3. Minnesota has a dominant win, at least on the scoreboard, against the Jets. The Saints go on the road and slip by the Ravens, but we see nearly a two-point adjustment with both teams coming in off a win.
I feel like we got a piece of information that we don't want to divulge on Monday. Is that why we skipped over that one game?
I mean, no, we can share. We can share if we'd like.
I'm busting your balls. Vikings Saints. You know, obviously the Saints are returning to the scene of the crime here, and they have revenge on their mind. You know, we know how electric and efficient that New Orleans pass offense is right now. The Vikings secondary was already beat up with injuries going into the Jets game with Mike Hughes out for the season. We saw Xavier Rhodes, a premier cover corner, leave with what appears to be, you know, at least this week an injury, I think. You know, we'll find out more from Dr. Chow here in a minute. Anthony Barr also dealing with a hamstring injury. Let's see if he goes. Probably not going to be 100% if he does. There's also another injury along the offensive line. You know, the Saints appear to be the side here.
Yeah, I wonder where this number goes. When you look at New Orleans right now, they did open actually a 2.5-point dog in some spots. We've seen that number trend towards one. So something to keep
in
mind.
Hear.
as you build out your betting card for the weekend. But not a ton of adjustments as we get deeper into the season in terms of the look-aheads, but where you do have to make some changes is with your injury report.
Are you injured or are you
When injuries occur in the NFL, there's only one man to turn to.
If you're hurt, you can still play. If you're injured, you can't.
Let's check in with 17-year NFL team doctor turned medical analyst, Dr. David Chow.
So are you hurt or are you injured?
This is Chow's Corner.
It's a Monday morning here on the Bet the Board podcast, so that can mean only one thing. We go to our medical expert, and you can follow him on Twitter at ProFootballDoc. Dr. David Chow has an extensive resume, makes him much better equipped to handle all of the aftermath and carnage we saw from the previous week. And Dr. Chow, we saw a couple key contributors at the running back position go down over the weekend. And one I wanted to ask you about on the London flight, supposedly, Melvin Gordon, a late scratch early morning for the Chargers for their game against the Titans. Coach Anthony Lynn says it's a hamstring, but the subtle undertones of that dialogue lead me to believe it wasn't just a hamstring injury from practice, that it may have had something to do with the travel here.
Well, I mean, you could theorize that, but the last time the Chargers were in London, I was with them. And even 10 years ago, the travel over was on a big old 747 where it's like flying in your living room or a house. So it wasn't exactly cramped and, you know, much bigger plane and you know, food and drinks when you get on and moving around. And, you know, you don't love the flight, but I think you're hard pressed to just blame the flight on the hamstring. And by the way, you know, there's some rumor out there, a report that the Chargers may get investigated for the late week ad. I don't think so. I mean, there might be one phone call. They flew out on Thursday to London. He got hurt on Friday or tweaked his hamstring on Friday. They added him to the injury report. By the next day, it was more sore. They made him questionable and he didn't start. I mean, that fact pattern is just not going to lead to any discipline for the Chargers.
No, when we look at hamstrings, and I know there are a couple other running back injuries that I'll let Payne get to in a second. Leonard Fournette has been a big topic of discussion. Earlier this week, the Jags say, we're hopeful he's going to be available for the Texans. But clearly, you go out and you trade for a running back in Carlos Hyde. Leonard Fournette doesn't appear anywhere close to actually taking snaps as the Jaguars featured back.
Well, you know, hamstrings are unpredictable. There's no question. And not every strain is the same. And he obviously had the setback when he tried to return. And I've been saying for weeks that don't even look for him until you see three straight full practices, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. That's probably going to be the bar. And in fact, that was likely to perhaps happen after the week 9 bye. And I think there's a report from Schefter that that's probably the plan now.
And Dr. Chow, another running back that I kind of wanted to inquire about was Belichick's new bell cow, Sony Michel. Looked like he got violently spun down. It looked really awkward. Clearly, he was in some pain, right? He dropped the ball. What do we know about Sony Michel's injury? And is it the same knee that's had him listed on the injury report the last few weeks?
Well, of course, as you know, on injury reports, they don't list which knee, but by assumption and by detective work, it appears to be the same knee. Sony Michel's been sort of the new normal for him is some limited practice and questionable because of that left knee, because of that same knee, same left knee that had him dropping in the draft, the degenerative changes, the microfracture, the previous ACL. So it does appear to be the same knee, and that is the bad news. The good news is my take by video, and it's just video, and admittedly the sideline view had the defender blocking the knee, and the end zone view, ironically enough, that was shown on TV, had the goalpost block the right moment of the twisting of the left knee. So I cannot be 100% sure, but it does not look to me to be season ending. It does not look to me to be an ACL or MCL or major ligament issue. I'd be more worried about a potential meniscus tear. Obviously, MRI is pending, and we'll keep our fingers crossed. And by the way, the ankle to many looked bad, but he really escapes any ankle issue.
hopefully some good news for Sony Michel there. We know Brady and Belichick have that next man up attitude, so they seem to absorb these injuries pretty well. I wanted to ask you about Xavier Rhodes, the standout corner there for the Vikings. He leaves the Jets game early. You see him kind of grabbing the mid or high part of his ankle there. He couldn't put any pressure on it as he was being assisted off. What is the injury there, and what's the timeline for recovery with Xavier Rhodes?
Well, to me, it looks like a significant ankle sprain. No fracture, no surgery, not season ending, and it does not appear to be a high one either. It's a standard low inversion basketball type sprain, although likely a significant one that's likely to swell. Probably see reports today that he's in a boot, etc. It's going to be tough for a short turnaround, but it's certainly not going to be anything long term. And I think part of it is, once again, the cautionary tale, and I'll call it part three. First was Aaron Rodgers carted off, and everyone thought the world was over, and Cooper Kupp carted off, and yet he came back. Xavier Rhodes was carted off. I mean, he really limped getting off and carted off. But that's why I say, look at the injury itself. Don't look at the reaction to the injury. And perhaps you guys do this all the time. Look at the game itself. Don't look at the final score or the reaction to the game. Look at the game itself in terms of how you make your decisions.
That certainly makes sense. And that would be a tough injury to absorb with Mike Hughes down already and Drew Brees and that offense coming to town. The last player I wanted to ask you about, Dolphins speedster Albert Wilson. He's been a dynamite this season with his run after catch ability. That was a real awkward play. They kind of leaned him over on his side while he was on the field checking his hip. He did walk off. I saw that. They put him in the blue tent. He quickly went back to the locker room and was done for the day. What do we know about Albert Wilson's injury and maybe some long-term impacts? He's probably doubtful for Thursday, I would think.
Well, I think, which Thursday are you talking about? 4 weeks from now? Yeah. <he's, laughs> I mean, Thursday is out of the question completely. His agent, in kind of an unusual move, but I guess not unusual for Drew Rosenhaus, came out and spoke about a hip injury and said it was significant and even hinted at potentially season. And so I went back and looked at the video and did see some pretty good video where he gets kind of tackled from behind and then takes an awkward step and really flexes up his hip while his knee's extended and jams it. And that is worrisome for a right hip posterior subluxation or transient dislocation, which would actually put the posterior labrum at risk and potentially a bone bruise. Now, you don't hear about hip injuries or hip dislocations very often because it's really a ball and socket joint. So it is really very stable. And as opposed to a shoulder joint where we hear about all the time, where it's more a golf ball on a tee and it comes out. But a shoulder joint like Adrian Peterson can dislocate it because it's a golf ball on a tee. Less trauma can make it dislocate, which means it's less sore and he was able to come back in and play with a brace, et cetera. A hip joint takes a lot of violent force to sublux or dislocate. So there's no way he's coming back anytime soon. I mean, a good news would be if he came back in a month. That would be good news. And this easily could be season. I'm sure they're getting an MRI to make final decisions. And if the labrum is torn, it could also mean surgery.
Hits keep coming for Payne's Dolphins, but Dr. Chow, leave it to Payne to ask about a pass catcher for the Dolphins and not the team everyone actually cares about in the division, in the New England Patriots. Rob Gronkowski doesn't travel with the Pats to their game to Soldier Field against the Bears. What have you heard about his injury, and is this something we're going to have to monitor week to week, or was this more precautionary from New England?
Well, you hope it's precautionary. I mean, New England follow the injury reporting rules, but normally when you don't make a flight, you're declared out. And he didn't make a flight, and he was declared doubtful. That's almost the same thing. I mean, I suppose he could have chartered his own plane and made it to Chicago, but I think it was pretty clear that he was going to sit this week. And I think everyone got very excited because they said back, and they said, oh my God, this is his back again. He had a back surgery in college, he had another back surgery in 2016. Here we go down a bad path again. But not necessarily. There's a lot of things that can happen in your back. Until I hear word that it's related to the previous surgery, that it's disc-related, I think the good news is there's a good chance that it's not. And I think Ian Rappaport even this morning had some indication that it wasn't going to be long-term, and that's been my hope all along on him.
And last but not least, there is one knee for a pretty prominent quarterback who had extra time to heal up for one of the marquee games of the weekend, Aaron Rodgers. We know he hasn't been quite 100% all season long under center for the Packers. But do you think the bye week came at the perfect time? And should we expect anything different as far as his mobility is concerned? Or what's Rodgers' prognosis going forward?
Yeah, well, the perfect time for the bye week would have been that week that where he had the setback. That would have been the perfect time. He probably would have been 100% by now. But with that slight setback a couple weeks ago, this bye will help tremendously. Yeah, I have full confidence that Aaron Rodgers will be himself. He's already started to take snaps under center. He at one point went to the smaller brace before the re-injury and went back up again. He's lobbying to have the brace off completely. I really think this is in our rearview mirror by the next time he plays.
Always good to hear you want the top signal callers out there, especially in a game that's going to get all sorts of national attention, as Rodgers will enter as the largest underdog in his illustrious NFL career, especially during the regular season. You can follow Dr. David Chow on Twitter at ProFootballDoc. He is the single best authority on all things NFL injury related, and his late week updates are the perfect addition to your handicapping and fantasy regimen. Dr. Chow, can't thank you enough for your time again this morning. Look forward to chatting with you real soon.
Always fun. Thanks, guys.
Always great stuff there, Payne. And you mentioned it, the Patriots mentality about next man up. How much does this offense, in your opinion, change if Sony Michel is out for an extended period of time?
It certainly removes the ground and pound aspect from them a little bit, but it means what? More Tom Brady, more White out of the backfield. Hopefully other defenses don't try to stick defensive ends on White out of the backfield like the Bears did.
You can let it go, buddy. You let it go. Let it go.
So it means more Brady. It means more James White. I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing. It does remove an element from their game, which they like to employ sometimes, right? It's just a versatility thing. But right now they're red hot. And that signing of Gordon seems to be fantastic. It's going to end up amounting to what looks like a sixth round pick. And they're going to have him under contract next year, I believe, because of the supplemental draft situation there. And he's going to be on the books for like $2 million next year, too. So, I mean, just Belichick twisting the Browns' brain into a pretzel for that pick. So,
like
he just
does
everything better than everyone. We're going to keep saying it, obviously, but it's obvious he's just better than everybody.
Yeah, I'm still not sure Bill's going to be the head coach in New England next year. I mean, that's a topic we'll address later in the campaign. I still believe that he ends up somewhere else when we're talking about the NFL this time next year. But ultimately, we'll see that unfold, and it's cliche, but the harder you work, the luckier you get, and the Patriots do it better than just about anybody in the league.
I'm going to cut you off and say something.
Sure, fire away.
Because you have not said in the 5 years of this podcast something more wow than what you just said. Where are we coming up with this Belichick not being or
I just
Belichick
don't think
coaching for another team, not even just retiring, coaching for another team?
I think there's a part of me that says, and this is not from Intel or anything else close to this situation, I just think when his contract is up at the end of this year, even with Josh Gordon there, Rob Gronkowski continuing to deal with chronic injuries, that Belichick goes, you know what, I'm going to try and win one more Super Bowl here in New England, but for me to be able to separate my legacy from Tom Brady, I have to go somewhere else and take over another franchise. And if I'm looking around, trying to figure out where, and if Bill has his ego,
oh man,
what better? Do you think you know where I'm going with this?
The Browns.
That's exactly what I was going to say. What better spot for him to go to than where he's got relationships and he's got a quarterback that he could potentially build around, where he started his career, to maybe go, you know what? I'm going to try and win with Baker Mayfield. I like the roster here. I'm going to be the guy in Cleveland.
I like this. He'll only be 67, and his birthday is in April, I believe. So he'll be 67. Yeah, I mean, he's still got probably a nice 3-year window there.
Yeah, I mean, he's not going to a spot that it's a full rebuild, and you look around, I can't see him going to the Jets or somewhere else with another young quarterback, but we know the Patriots coveted Baker Mayfield to a certain extent. They had talked about him. What better way to go, you know what? I'm going to be the guy there. Give me 3 to 5 year window. I'm going to turn the Browns into a winner, and that's how I'm going to ride my white horse off into the sunset.
I like what you just did there, and you backed up the wow statement. This wasn't Skip Bayless-like. This was good.
No, this ain't hot take you around here. We like to think about what we're going to say and try and put the pieces together.
I'm glad that I grilled you on this, because that's probably pretty good thinking there with the Browns.
Well, I mean, and you brought an element to my attention with the Browns that we may see unfold in the next couple of weeks.
There is certainly, what time is it right now? It is 7 a.m. Vegas time. There's probably some chatter going on between owner and Dorsey today on the timeline for Hugh Jackson. I don't know if they're going to shit can him before a big division game, but certainly if you get blown out there at Pittsburgh this week, could be tough for Hugh to keep his job.
They haven't had their bye yet, have they?
They have not.
So, okay. So that gives them a logical time if they want to try and make changes there. But just something to think about. Again, not going to say that we have any inside information, just dominoes that could potentially line up for some interesting shuffling of key figures in the National Football League. And I would have normally said, Payne, that Bill Belichick could have been the head coach for this team, but I don't think the Giants are going to go in that direction. Giants, 4-point underdogs tonight against the Atlanta Falcons. Total in this game, 52.5 at betonline.ag. I want to talk about the line move first and foremost. This number has ping-ponged all over the place. Open 3.5, 4, got as high as 6, 6.5, and has come back down, settled in that 4 range. What do you make of the movement around some secondary key numbers?
Agree with the move down. Initially in the week, it did open 3.5 at the sharp shops. There was some obvious work done there. Got as high as 6.5 some places, and that's, you know, there's a couple buy points on the Giants. It was a game that got dummied up and then hammered. The lowest buy point that I know of, and when we're still not there, so I don't want to give out that advice. The lowest buy point I've seen from groups is at 4.5. So now at 3.5, 4, I haven't seen an appetite for the Giants at that number. But again, it's certainly early in the day. And it looks like a couple key cogs for Atlanta could be back. It looks like Grady Jarrett will return. And with the Atlanta bye on deck, maybe, you know, you're going to put Ridley out there. You're going to put Sanu out there for what feels like, you know, a must-win game for Atlanta as well. So I doubt they're going to not play those guys, even though they're less than 100%.
Yeah, you mentioned the must-win scenario for the Falcons, and they've had an unequal distribution of home games and their front-loaded portion of the schedule and haven't exactly lived up to expectations thus far. Devontae Freeman to IR, and I ask you, because you haven't been a Tevin Coleman guy, and rightfully so, probably. I mean, when you consider the fact he's now their primary running back, but the Falcons have attempted fewer rushes than any team in the league. If Coleman could be that guy, even with Ito Smith there to share the workload in the backfield, don't you think they'd be running the football a little bit more than they have to try and mask some of the deficiencies they have on the defensive side?
You would think. Ish Smith isn't a bad guy out of Southern Miss. He's a little more dartier. He's had a couple nice touchdown runs. He can catch the ball out of the backfield. It doesn't feel like it's an offense that wants a full workload from anyone. Even when they had Devontae Freeman, they were still kind of handing the ball off to Coleman, using him in the back out of the backfield, catching balls. So feels like they're not a team that wants a workhorse. Who knows? Obviously, if you had an elite talent, maybe you are. But, you know, Atlanta's offense, one, is going to be, you know, it's going to be Matt Ryan, Julio Jones, and their game script. They're in shootouts. So we're going to see a lot more passing, I would think. This just feels like a team that's Matt Ryan based, that's Julio Jones based. You go out and you had deficiencies in other areas and you draft Calvin Ridley anyways. And then, you have Sanu as well. Happy to see what the Falcons are doing offensively. They figured out how good Austin Hooper was after a few years. Took them multiple years. But it looks like they woke up in the Pittsburgh game and said, hey, we can throw the ball over the middle of the field a little bit here, and this Hooper guy, he ain't half too bad. Matt Ryan spent most of the summer together training with Austin Hooper. I thought it was going to be something nice progressing from the onset of the season. Just wasn't the case, and I know fantasy guys could have picked up Hooper off the waiver wire a couple weeks ago, and he's just been dynamic the last few weeks. So it feels like a pass first offense, especially when you invest. It's 2018, number one, but it's you invest in Matt Ryan, you have Julio Jones. It's always going to be predicated, I would think, on the pass here.
And when we look at Atlanta, I mean, we know about their defensive metrics towards the bottom of the league alongside the Kansas City Chiefs, obviously with some very different results in the win-loss column. Defense ranks 29th against the pass, 30th in total yards allowed, 31st in points allowed, and dead last in third down defense. And the reason I bring that up, Payne, is to ask you about this Giants offense, which we know has playmakers. Eli Manning this season, his 68% completion percentage would be a career best. Interception percentage is lower than it's ever been, and he's on pace to throw for more than 4,000 yards. But can the Giants do enough offensively to put pressure on Atlanta's defense?
I would think so. Some of those numbers you mentioned are great for Eli. And honestly, this would feel like a game to me that probably determines the rest of his career, right? If he stubs his toe here in this spot, I would think potentially it's Kyle Luletta time. See what you have there. If you go 1-15, so be it. You can draft, you know, Justin Herbert at that point. Now for the next half decade, your offense has four talented young dudes with, you know, Herbert, Saquon, Odell, and Ingram. You know, again, I think Eli will have some success here. Where Manning's really gotten in trouble this year is, you look, it's pressure. It's pressure in his face. He's completing 46% of his passes, has a 55 passer rating when he's under duress. And that's been a lot with this offensive line. I know fans and Odell Beckham have been kind of, you know, clamoring for Eli to take deeper shots. And some of that is on Eli. Most of it, though, is there's just not enough time to, like, design these elaborate deep shots. The one positive that you'll find tonight is Atlanta doesn't get after the quarterback. 28th in adjusted sack rate. They're 29th in pressure rate. And when you look where Eli likes to throw the ball this year, it's short. It's to Saquon. Shermer's offense is designed to throw to running backs. And now you have an Atlanta defense that's allowed the most running back passes 3 years in a row. And we know Deion Jones, he's the best cover linebacker in the NFL. He's out, obviously. Both safeties, Keanu Neal and Ricardo Allen, are out. So when you look defensively at the film, there's like this just huge void in the middle of the field. And so I went back and looked at this. If you track all three phases of passes, short, intermediate, and deep, the Falcons defense have allowed a grand total of 77% of passes to be completed in the middle of the field combined at all three levels. So getting a guy like Evan Ingram back this week, that could help too over the middle of the field. They haven't been able to stop the run. They do get Grady Jarrett back. That should help. But maybe the offense for the Giants becomes two-dimensional, where you can get Saquon going in the ground game, because the Falcons defense, 56% of runs have graded successful. So you would think the Giants offense is going to have success here tonight.
I want to come full circle, not the Giants offense necessarily, against the Falcons defense, where we think the Giants will be able to get the ball to their playmakers in space. We know Atlanta's offense is dynamic, especially in the dome, but they've had some of their own struggles from time to time. How does the Giants defense match up with Atlanta's offense? And can Olivier Vernon potentially finally get an increased snap count this week? He's had roughly 10 days since his season debut against the Eagles. And will the Giants be able to get pressure on Matt Ryan to kind of knock him off his spot?
Well, I thought Vernon performed pretty damn well against Philly. If you remember, I thought he'd be back the week prior, and it was trending towards that, and then he had a setback late in that week. And suddenly, the short week, he played in, and it was like a do-or-die game, obviously, within the division. But he looked pretty good. He took more snaps than I thought he would. He seemed pretty dominant. And let's remember, like, I know everyone thinks Olivier Vernon, defensive end, they signed him this massive deal, and he's just like this elite pass rusher, and he can get after the quarterback, but he is an elite run-stopping edge, so I think he's good in both regards. Now, he's dealing with a rib injury now. He got dinged up in the Philly game, and he was questionable for this game. It looks like he's trending towards playing. You obviously want to get some pressure on Matt Ryan. You know, the reason, obviously, the total is sitting here at 53. There's a reason it's that high. I don't think the Giants defense is going to pitch a shutout here tonight.
They do. Then we have a story all of a sudden.
Yeah, I mean, the Giants secondary, they're allowing 7 yards per pass attempt. That's like 17th in the NFL. Oddly, though, you look at some of the pass defense situationally, they've been okay. 8th in passing success rate defense. What the Giants defense needs to do is limit the explosive plays. They've given up 25 explosive passes in 6 games, 12% of all passes have graded explosive. That's 4th worst in the NFL. The hope is Jackrabbit, Janoris Jenkins, can do something to man Julio Jones. And if he can somewhat remove him from this game, it's a tough thing to do. But if you can make him average or above average in this game, just have an elite game from Janoris Jenkins, you might have a chance here. Ridley and Sanu look like they're going to play, but they're certainly neither of them are 100%. So, you know, it doesn't look like they're going to have much of a ground game here either. So, you know, let's see. I can tell you the Giants are the side here tonight. At 3.5, it becomes significantly more difficult. And again, 4.5 was the last buy point I saw. If you can get 4.5, maybe it's worth a little something. But at this point, at 3.5 or 4 juiced, you know, it's much tougher.
Yeah, as I say, the numbers come down, lost a little bit of the value. I mean, I want to try and dig into some of the Saquon Barkley stuff that's out there. I'm curious to see where some of those potential props may open.
Could be room for an edge there.
hope for a little bit of wiggle room on Monday Night Football, but we've done the breakdowns. We've offered the look-ahead lines. We've talked to Dr. David Chow about all the injuries you need to keep tabs on going forward, shared our sentiments from the weekend. Is there, Payne, I mean, is there worth a movies and popcorn bet to be found in this Falcons-Giants game, even if it's not a full position?
I don't see it at this number. You would think the Giants, if they are going to have a chance here, would come out early and have some success. Maybe you look that way. If it's only 3.5 in the first half, is there still 3 out there in the first half?
Hold on 1 second.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little 3 out there. Maybe that's an angle you want to attack a little bit. Like, I don't see a ton here at this number. I just don't want to start advising people to say, you know, go take 3.5 on a game that you could have had 7 on the bye, or 6.5. Like, I don't endorse that kind of stuff. But you would think the Giants have to come out fast tonight. The season's about done at this point. You had the owner call out Odell Beckham Jr., and Odell Beckham Jr. kind of apologized in his way. I think we're going to see a lot from this Giants offense. They've historically been very good on the road. They've historically been fantastic as a road dog, despite their ineptitude in recent years. So it just feels like a good spot here. All the pressure's on Atlanta.
Yeah, I mean, this is a Falcons team, needs to perform under the bright lights. You mentioned the Giants. They've played 3 road games this season. Their total point differential for the year, -4. Average margin of defeat, 1.3 points. So that would be more than comfortable enough to get you through there if you're able to see a 4.5 pop, maybe, should you want to dabble and be entertained this fine evening. All right, Payne, we've done enough damage for a Monday morning, at least in my opinion. Got to try and dig into some of these numbers and figure out what the hell the game plan will look like for this week. Any final words of wisdom, parting shots, rants, anything you'd like to get off your chest?
No, that's it. It was a pretty concise Monday, in and out. There wasn't a ton, like, the games were good this past weekend, but there wasn't like a ton of just like wow stuff to talk about, I didn't think.
Yeah, I don't think there was anything that really surprised you. A lot of these games around the number, we knew where some of the professional money had come in on these sides. And while it didn't necessarily unfold that way for 60 minutes, a play here, a play there, we have very different storylines that are worth addressing. And I think that's part of what you look at. I mean, folks are going to go, oh, well, this number surprised me. You may have seen some sharp money that got buried on the 49ers-Rams game. But, I mean, for example, that's a game we talked about and said there was no way you were going to be able to pay us, regardless of who was on the dog, for us to back them in that spot.
Terrible spot. And it just, you could tell it was a young team. They got their hearts ripped out on Monday Night Football. They were the team with all the travel, too. It's like the home game, but you were traveling under the short week, so you kind of removed some of that home aspect. It's not a great home field advantage to begin with, especially, you know, with the Rams coming to town. It just, I don't know. I feel bad for Kyle Shanahan.
He's got his hands full, but he's been given a long leash from yes. John Lynch. I don't think his job security is in peril.
No,
I mean,
they took both of them. Took 6-year deals, right?
Yeah, whatever doesn't kill you, I mean, makes you stronger. And his track record of building offenses, if he can keep his guys healthy, I think they'll be headed in the right direction. And you know what? It's funny about the 49ers. Maybe next year we'll actually be able to get a value on their win total like we wanted this offseason.
Let's hope.
All right, that'll do it for us here at the Bet the Board podcast on this fine Monday morning. Remember, follow Dr. David Chow on Twitter at ProFootballDoc. You can follow Payne on Twitter as well at Payne Insider. I am Todd Furman. You can follow me there. And should you get bored and want to try and spam a timeline, make sure to show our boy Dave Mason some love at Dave Mason BOL. Best of luck this fine Monday with all of your investment opportunities on the Giants-Falcons game. Hopefully, come late Monday night, we'll be able to see you at the window.